From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. UC Davis is usually a pretty calm campus, but less so right now because of the way police handled a student protest on Friday and the aftermath. Pepper spray was used on protesters sitting on the ground. At first, campus officials stood by the police, but then the officers were suspended, then the police chief, and now there are calls for the Davis chancellor to step down. In a few minutes, we hope to talk with an official at UC Davis, also a journalist who's covering the story on campus. But first, the assistant professor of English at UC Davis, who called in an open letter on Friday for the chancellor of UC Davis, Linda Katehi, to resign because of the pepper spray incident. Nathan Brown is a board member of the Davis Faculty Association. I started by asking Nathan Brown why he thinks Katehi should resign because of this incident.
The chancellor justifies the actions of the police on our campus last week by citing health and safety concerns. The primary reason that I think the chancellor should resign is that she is, in fact, a primary threat to the health and safety of students on our campus, and that's what we witnessed last Friday.
When you say she's a primary threat to the health and safety of students, what do you mean by that? I mean, there was a pepper spray incident on campus involving police, but that's a very broad statement you just made.
Well, the chancellors of the UC system for the past 2 years have systematically ordered the use of police force against UC student and faculty protesters as a means of suppressing dissent and suppressing free speech and, in fact, terrorizing students and faculty, and that's what you saw last Friday. The chancellor knows that the previous week at Berkeley, there had been an incident in which the chancellor of Berkeley ordered police onto campus to remove tents. Student protesters linked arms and held their ground in front of the police, and those student protesters and faculty protesters as well were beaten, hospitalized, and arrested by those police officers. 1 week later, the chancellor sends the same order to the police to come onto campus and to forcibly remove student protesters and tents from the campus. And exactly the same thing happened. The chancellor has to be aware that she is culpable for the actions of the police that she calls onto the campus. And given the example of Berkeley the previous week, there's no reason for her not to expect that exactly what happened on our campus would have happened.
So you think that she could have anticipated that pepper spray would be used on seated protesters?
I didn't say that specifically. What I said is that she ordered UCPD to forcibly remove the encampment at UC Davis. And what I'm saying is that given the use of police violence against student and faculty protesters on a consistent basis for the past 2 years on our campuses, given the police violence against student protesters at Berkeley the previous week, in exactly the same situation, the chancellor is, let's just say, in an excellent position to anticipate that there would be such an incident of police violence on our campus when she ordered police in to clear student protesters once again. I reiterate that police brutality is a tool which is systematically used by the upper administration of the UC system to terrorize students into not protesting, which doesn't work, and to force students to pay higher tuition increases. Police brutality is a means of enforcing tuition increases on our campus.
What do you think the campus police should have done instead regarding the tents that have been put up on campus?
Well, this is exactly the point. The campus police are under orders to clear those tents by the chancellor. That's why I hold the chancellor responsible for what happened on campus. Of course, the office responsible, and of course the chief of the UC Davis Police Department should be forced to resign as well with this incident. But I hold Chancellor Tate responsible for what happened because she ordered the removal of those tents. She in no way situation or attempted to de-escalate the situation in such a way that what happened wouldn't have happened. Those police are acting on orders to remove that encampment by force, and they carried out her orders.
You are a board member of the Davis Faculty Association. And the faculty association has differences of opinion, significant differences of opinion with the senior administration of the University of California over what the association has called the privatization of the University of California. Is your specific criticism of Linda Katahi in this incident connected in any way to broader criticisms that you and your colleagues on the association have about the UC administration?
It certainly is. What students are protesting on our campuses are the massive tuition increases that have taken place for the past 10 years or so and that are continuing to take place. UC President Mark Udoff has just proposed a plan to increase tuition by a further 81% over the next 4 years. And one has to understand the magnitude of these tuition increases. In 2005, tuition on UC campuses was around $6,000. It's currently around $13,000. And if President Udoff's plan is carried through by 2015, tuition on our campuses would be around $23,000. And students can't pay that much money. They can't continue to go further into debt. And what we see is when they protest those tuition increases, when they say, no, I refuse to pay more for tuition, I refuse to take on more debt, when they protest in that way, they are beaten by the police. And that's why I say that police brutality on our campuses is a tool which is systematically used by the administration to enforce tuition increases.
Nathan Brown is an assistant professor of English at UC Davis and a member of the Davis Faculty Association. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
We still hope to speak with someone from UC Davis this morning on Insight, but we don't have someone scheduled right at this moment. But joining us now on the phone from UC Davis is Sacramento Bee reporter Sam Stanton, who's covering the story. Sam, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. What's happening on campus today?
Well, right now there's about a half dozen media trucks, network trucks, Bay Area folks, positioned outside the student union, and they're all waiting for this noon rally with the expectation that Chancellor Katahi will come and possibly speak at it.
So the expectation is that the chancellor will speak at this rally, which is a rally principally of students, I guess?
Yes. There's already a couple dozen students sitting around in a circle near where the pepper spray incident began on Friday. There's one small bouquet of flowers out there, and people are pretty much hanging around the student union waiting to see what happens. There's some joking inside the building about how Katahi has succeeded in her quest to get UC Davis to be nationally known. So we're just waiting to see what happens. There's no massive crowd yet, no evidence of anyone being bussed in to pose any problems, and I haven't seen a single campus police officer anywhere this morning.
Where will the rally at noon happen?
Well, apparently it's going to happen right out here in front of the student union, out in the quad area. But there's nothing that's really set up to give an indication of who's going to be speaking. There are no signs. Nothing really unusual. It looks like a normal day on a university campus, except for the TV trucks, of course.
Yes. What about the site of the incident on Friday where the pepper spray was used? Are there still protesters there? Is that area still open?
It's open. There's just some students sitting around. There's really not a lot of evidence about to show what happened here Friday, other than a small piece of paper taped to a lamp post that has the numbers of local news agencies for students apparently to call if they have news to impart.
Since Friday, there's been quite a bit of change in the personnel in the UC Davis campus police department. Two officers were suspended over the weekend, and then this morning, if I'm not mistaken, it was this morning that the police chief was also put on leave. Who's in charge now?
The UC Davis folks sent out a release about the police chief being placed on leave around 4 this morning. So that gives you any idea of how they were working through the weekend to handle things. They put a lieutenant in charge in the meantime. We've discovered that one of the officers who allegedly was involved in the pepper spray incident has received 2 commendations from the university over the years for heroism. In fact, in a 2007 incident, a press release that they issued at the time lauded him for saving 2 of his partners by tackling a suspect. And he said he didn't use his pepper spray in that incident because he didn't want to spray his partner inadvertently.
I see. Sam Stanton of the Sacramento Bee joining us from the UC Davis campus. He's covering the story, the aftermath to the pepper spray incident on Friday. As he said, there is going to be the schedule to be a student rally at noon, and perhaps Chancellor Linda Katehi will be speaking at that event. Sam Stanton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. We are not able to speak with an official from UC Davis this morning, but we hope to do that tomorrow morning. By the way, we've also had to reschedule one of the topics we planned to discuss this morning because of our UC Davis coverage. The topic is what Californians are doing to save state parks from being closed. We hope to have that discussion early next week on Insight. When we come back, four California trucking companies are suing the Environmental Protection Agency over new emission standards. One of them is from Sacramento. We'll talk with the head of that company in a moment. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Joining us today for Insight Online is senior producer Jen Picard. Hi, Jen.
Hi, well, good morning. Well, we're going to follow up some more on the news this weekend. The Occupy protest at UC Davis became national news over the weekend when videos of officers using pepper spray on seated protesters went viral on the internet. The UC Davis campus police chief was placed on administrative leave today, and an investigation into the use of force on students has been requested by Chancellor Katehi. The incident has sparked heated debate about police action on campuses and what is considered appropriate force to use against protesters who refuse to disperse. What do you think about the situation? In what instances do you think it's appropriate to use pepper spray, if any? And how do you think UC Davis should handle the fallout? Let us know on our Facebook page, Insight at Capital Public Radio, or send an email to insight@capradio.org.
Thank you, Jen.
You're welcome.
Four California trucking companies are suing the Environmental Protection Agency over new emission standards. They say the regulations would raise their costs and that the process the EPA followed was flawed. One of those four companies is from the Sacramento area, and the organization representing them is based here, too. We'll start our discussion with Norman Skip Brown, who's owner of Delta Construction Company. It's one of four California trucking companies suing the EPA, and they are based in the area, the industrial area, off Jackson Road to the east of Sacramento. Skip, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the invite.
What's your objection? Why do you object to the EPA regulations on emissions?
Well, essentially, you'll put us out of business.
How do you mean?
Well, we're caught between a rock and a hard spot. I'm the owner of a 68-year business started by my dad in the state of California and been surviving ever since, and we provide a product for the community, and we get paid for that product, and we use diesel equipment. Now, this regulation coming on, which will raise the cost of new diesel engines severely, will be impossible to be able to buy the new engines because of the increased costs. And at the same time, the California Air Regulations, Air Resources Board, has made our older diesel equipment in the near future, illegal to use or sell in the state of California.
And that's a separate
separate process and a whole separate topic, but that's the rock and the EPA is the hard spot, and that's where we're at.
Now, when you say that these regulations would raise the cost of diesel engines that would make them impossible for you to buy, what do you mean by that? How much would it raise the cost?
Well, we have no idea because the technology hasn't been developed yet. They have yet to develop the technology, to my understanding, so we do not know what the cost is going to be. And then we have a very small usage of the equipment nowadays because the economy is in such a tank. Just survival at this point in time is the only thing that we can try to do. Myself personally, I haven't taken a salary from my company in 3 years so I can keep my employees.
But as I understand, these new regulations would only require the cut in emissions by 2018. So that's quite a few years off, is it not?
Well, anybody that's been in business for more than a week or two looks for long term. And we invest in assets that are intended to survive at least 5 to 10 years if you're large. And if you're small, they need to survive even longer than that. And we, in the small business community, will pick up assets from the larger businesses who will liquidate the assets in maybe 4 to 5 years, and they use them quite extensively. But in our businesses, we use the assets less often, so they have to survive longer, and they have to cost a lot less in order for us to purchase them. But when you take the used equipment off of the market completely, We cannot buy or use the used equipment because it doesn't meet the new regulations imposed on this state. And then you have the new assets costing so much more, and we're not be able to use them as much because we don't have an economy to use them. It means that there's no return on investment. Therefore, there will be no investment.
We're talking about how some companies, including Delta Construction Company of the Sacramento region, are reacting to new regulations from the U.S. EPA that would require reduced emissions from diesel engines by 2018. Also with us is Ted Hadjiantich, who's senior staff attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, which is representing the trucking companies. Ted, welcome to Insight.
Pleasure to be here.
Specifically, what are these new regulations? What exactly do they require?
These regulations govern greenhouse gas emissions from heavy-duty and medium-sized vehicles, primarily trucks and buses and so forth. But they're part of a greater effort by EPA to regulate greenhouse gases throughout the economy. To really put the regulations in context, you need to go back to December of 2009 when President Obama gave a speech in Copenhagen, during which he tried to get a consensus from world leaders about greenhouse gas regulation moving forward. That consensus never happened, but immediately after the speech, the United States Environmental Protection Agency promulgated what's called the endangerment finding. And that was the foundation for all greenhouse gas regulation in the United States on a federal level. The endangerment finding basically states that the EPA finds that greenhouse gas emissions, primarily carbon dioxide, poses a threat to human health and the environment. Now, one of the problems in promulgating that rule is that the EPA missed a step. It completely neglected to send the proposed regulation before it was finalized to the Science Advisory Board, which is a blue ribbon panel of scientists created by statute. And EPA was required to send the endangerment finding to the Science Advisory Board for peer review, which it utterly failed to do. So Pacific Legal Foundation challenged the endangerment finding in court. That's now in the United States District Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. It's been briefed. We're just waiting for the oral argument in February. But the reason I mention that is that that set the foundation for all future greenhouse gas regulations, including the regulations that we're talking about today, the heavy-duty vehicle regulations.
So these regulations pertain to climate change, not pollution.
They pertain to climate change and not. I mean, carbon dioxide is a ubiquitous natural substance. Each one of us sitting here today and every one of your audience members is a major emission source of carbon dioxide. Every time we exhale, we emit carbon dioxide.
Right. But a diesel engine emits a lot more than a human does.
Individual diesel engine versus individual human, that's true. But the point is this, that with regard to the endangerment finding, with regard to the heavy-duty vehicle regulation, there's also a light-duty vehicle regulation for greenhouse gas that's in effect. EPA has consistently failed to send these greenhouse gas regulations to the Science Advisory Board for peer review. And it's the first time since legal requirement was put into effect in 1977, that EPA failed to send a Clean Air Act regulation to its own science advisory board. What we're saying is this, that EPA is not above the law. All of us as individuals have to comply with the law. EPA also has to comply with the law, just like the rest of us.
By the way, listeners, we did invite the EPA to participate in this discussion, but they declined. We also invited them to send us a statement, which they have not done. My guests are Skip Brown, who's owner of Delta Construction Company, a California trucking company that's suing the EPA over emissions regulations, and Ted Hadjiantich, who's a senior staff attorney at Pacific Legal Foundation, which is representing the companies. Skip, specifically, what does your company do? What is the business you do?
Our main endeavor is road building. And we have heavy trucks in order to be able to complement our heavy equipment in order to build the roads, streets, and highways in California.
Is it not possible to do what you do without using trucks that use diesel engines?
Yeah, I guess we could bring the material in with helicopters.
I guess your answer is not really.
Not really.
No. Are your trucks, how old are the trucks that you currently use?
We have trucks in our fleet to go all the way back into the late 70s and early 80s. Yeah. That are used on an occasional basis. They're not the frontline trucks, but the frontline trucks will go out sometimes every day and sometimes weekly. But during the wintertime, of course, they don't go out at all because we don't do road building in the wintertime here in Northern California.
If you were to go out and replace one of those trucks with a new truck, what would it cost roughly?
The replacement cost for a new truck is going to range between $175,000 and $200,000.
Now, if these regulations do take effect, which is what they're scheduled to do, couldn't you just build whatever costs are imposed on your company into the cost of doing business? I mean, if you and all your competitors have to do this, then shouldn't all your customers have to just accept it?
Of course, and that's what will happen. The ones that survive, the businesses that survive, will be increasing the cost of their goods and services. But in the process, the smaller businesses will not be able to survive because they don't have the capital base of which to start replacing the equipment in today's economy. If we had an economy of 2003 through 2005, yes, we could be out replacing our asset base. But in today's economy, to go into debt or to invest capital for a piece of equipment that's not going to work very much is not a productive thing, and so you don't invest.
I would imagine that there are hundreds, maybe even thousands of companies affected by these regulations across the United States. Why are you one of a few companies that are involved in suing the EPA?
You can suggest maybe I'm a little bit proactive, having been in business myself for 45 years and seen, been through many recessions over the past 45 years and seen what they're doing to us in making our existing equipment illegal to use or sell. And raising the prices of the new equipment, it comes down to do I want to invest assets into a business that has perfectly good equipment that is no longer useful because of regulation? And the answer is no, I do not. And there are companies that will. The larger companies will survive. The smaller companies, which is the generator of most of the employment in California, will close the doors because of the cost to remain in business is too high. And passing the cost along to the consumer, that's fine. But we live in a competitive environment, and the low bidder gets the job. And so there are companies that will actually say, no, I'm just going to continue on using this stuff until you catch me doing it illegally, and then I'm going to give you this stuff because I'll take the money and run.
Ted, how did the Pacific Legal Foundation get involved in this? Did your organization look for companies like Delta so that you could sue the EPA, or did they approach you?
No. Originally, we brought the petition on the endangerment finding as Pacific Legal Foundation. And then when the other regulations started coming down the pike for light-duty vehicles and heavy-duty vehicles, we had already established a relationship with Skip and Delta Construction Company from other cases that we represented his company on.
Unrelated to this matter.
And we also found other clients that were interested. Now, I just wanted to correct you in two respects,
if
I may. We have four clients, that's correct, only one of whom is a trucking company. The other is a construction company, which is Skip's. And then the other remaining two are trade associations. There's a trade association of contractors and a trade association of trucking companies.
Okay.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is you said that the heavy-duty regulations weren't going into effect until 2018, but that's not accurate. There are actually two different sets of heavy-duty regulations. The first set, which is fully effective, will kick in for model year 2014, which actually begins January of 2013. So it's basically 1 year away before these new trucks will have to be built to the specifications of the regulations. And in connection with the costs for each additional heavy-duty truck, we're talking a minimum of several tens of thousands of dollars of additional cost per truck.
That's Ted Hadji-Antich, Senior Staff Attorney at Pacific Legal Foundation. Also with us was Norman Skip Brown, owner of Delta Construction Company. We've been talking about a lawsuit brought by four California companies, including Delta, suing the U.S. EPA over emissions regulations that they see would significantly raise the cost of doing business to the point that some would go out of business. Again, we did invite the EPA to participate. They declined. We invited them to send us a statement, which they've not yet done. Skip, Ted, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how do animals suffer? What responsibilities do humans have to prevent it? You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? Joining us with the answer to that is Alan Ray, Capital Public Radio Senior News Editor. He's in our newsroom. Alan, what's in the news?
Well, UC Davis, as you know, Jeffrey, kind of Zuccotti Park West, I guess. All this because of events that started with the pepper spraying of students on Friday escalated to the point that Chief of UC Davis Police has been placed on administrative leave. There's a noon rally on the campus today, and Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler will be there. He will report through the afternoon on what he found. The Deficit Super Committee of Congress is 2 days away from its deadline, and everybody agrees, or seems to, there will be no deal. Everybody involved also says it's the other guy who's at fault for the Super Committee's failure. On the other hand, not everybody thinks the Super Committee's inability to come up with an agreement is a failure. The stock market does seem to, though, not taking the news well. The Dow Industrial Average down almost 300 points and still dropping.
Whoa.
Yay. Those stories and much more on All Things Considered, beginning this afternoon at 3:30 on Capital Public Radio.
Alan Ray, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
How do animals suffer? What responsibilities do humans have to prevent it? Those questions are in part religious and philosophical. And it's the topic of a public lecture today on Sacramento State being given by a professor of philosophy at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. He's Joseph Lynch. He'll be talking at 1:30 this afternoon at the University Union in a talk with the provocative title of God and Animal Zombies. He's in our studio. Joseph Lynch, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Could you explain the title of the talk, God and Animal Zombies? It's very dramatic sounding.
Yes, it is. It is dramatic. The motivation for the talk is first the concept of the zombie. And when we're talking about a zombie in this sense, we don't mean the creatures that we see in movies that run into furniture and try to eat brains and things like that, as entertaining as that might be. I love zombie movies. But a philosophical zombie is a being very much like you or I, but there's nothing that it's like to be that being. There are no subjective conscious states. They don't have what we would call phenomenal consciousness.
In other words, you're talking about things that would look in a mirror and not know what they see.
Yeah, there might be a recognition system, but there would be nothing that it's like for them to see that image in the mirror. So there would be there might be a system that was complex enough that would allow them, say, to move away from harmful stimuli, to say ouch if they stubbed their toes, and so on. But they have no experience of what we would call pain. Nothing, no suffering, no experience of color, nothing like that. But they would say all the right things. And I was motivated by this from, it's been in the literature for a while, but David Chalmers, very well-known philosopher of mine, argued that it's conceivable that we have a world just like ours in every respect. The natural selection works in the same way and so on, except the beings in that world and the duplicates of you or I, that there's nothing that it's like to be those beings. And they could even have this conversation about consciousness, and yet, by what we usually mean by consciousness, they're not conscious at all.
Now, a lot of people over the millennia, I guess, and still today, believe that if an animal has less advanced consciousness than a human being, that therefore, as you said, they don't suffer, or at least not to the extent that we do. They don't experience pain in the same way that we do. But why would we assume that? I mean, just because something has less consciousness than we do, why would we assume that they therefore feel less?
Well, I would not assume that myself, but there are many standard and very old arguments about this, most famously, or perhaps we should say infamously, from Descartes.
The famous French philosopher from
yes.
the 1600s
yes.
or thereabouts.
And Descartes argued that animals are basically machines. We are machines as well, but we are machines with souls, with minds. We have conscious experiences. They don't. The only evidence that Descartes would allow for having conscious experience was the use of language. So he thought that there could perhaps be something that he would call sensation, but it wasn't sensation in the sense of a consciously felt sensation. So there are inputs, there are outputs, but again, those animals would be, from Descartes' point of view, what we would now call zombies. It's nothing that it's like to be them. We can't really harm them at all.
So what did Descartes conclude from that? He thought that animals were like machines. Did he go down that path to justify any kind of exploitation of animals?
He did not directly. He did say that that this would absolve us of any guilt for killing or eating them. But some followers of Descartes, the Port Royalists, would experiment on animals through vivisection. And according to one very famous story, they would often nail dogs up, crucified dogs to a piece of wood. And when the dog would scream out, as one might expect that it would, and if someone showed pity for the apparently suffering animal, they would laugh at that person, say, that's not the sound of suffering, but rather a broken spring. It'd be like if you're, to them, it was like if your car is making an odd noise, and I say, oh, my poor car is feeling badly today, you know, but the car, we might talk that way metaphorically, but we don't mean it literally. And that was what they were advancing, a sort of mechanical view of the universe. And the animals in it were machines, and human beings, being also God's creation, had this sort of distinctive role of being the conscious ones because we have souls.
So in that instance of the dog that was screaming in pain, it sounds like this was, but people saying that it was not really feeling the pain in the way that humans
right.
do. It sounds a bit like it quacks like a duck and it walks like a duck, but it isn't really a duck.
That's true, and it runs counter to nearly all of our deeply entrenched intuitions about what goes on. If Wittgenstein famously said about human beings now, he said, if I see a man writhing in pain before me, I don't say all the same his pain is hidden. It's pretty obvious, mm-hmm. right? But with the theoretical model that Descartes had, what seems obvious is no longer obvious. And what's kind of surprising is that in recent years, and in fact very recently, people are sort of adopting a neo-Cartesian view in the literature about animals. So it has levels of argumentation that Descartes himself did not appeal to. It doesn't say every animal that's not human is a machine. But it winds up in the same conclusion. Animals are not truly conscious beings in the way that consciousness matters to us.
Isn't that debate, doesn't it move beyond the philosophy department and into, let's say, the scientific departments where sometimes animals are used for research?
Well, yes, it does. And to my surprise, I happen to edit a journal about ethics and animals called Between the Species. But I haven't found very many people who are engaged in the use of animals and experimentation who actually take seriously the idea that they don't suffer at all. In fact, much experimentation of animals depends on the fact that they do suffer, in fact. So, but rather that the idea there seems to be that the payoff, at least for us, is worth the suffering of the animals. They will sometimes argue the animals, as you were saying earlier, might suffer in a different way. It doesn't count as much, but they rarely go the sort of radical neo-Cartesian view. Say they seem to be suffering, but they're not.
But it does sound like it is somewhat neo-Cartesian, to use the phrase you used. It says, yeah, okay, they are suffering, but there's a greater good here.
Yeah, well, it's I guess you could say it's neo-Cartesian, if you're going to get the same sort of justification of the of whatever sort of activities in which you're engaging. What's radical about the Cartesian view, it seems to me, is that it denies what most of us take as obvious, right? It's one thing if I want to say, well, the suffering of this creature, I acknowledge that it's suffering, but its suffering is, for whatever reason I wish to offer, less important than the human species. This is what Peter Singer and others have called speciesists. You know, our suffering is more important. Why? Because, you know, it's us. And Peter Singer position was, well, speciesism is sort of like racism or sexism or any other ism like that that sort of unjustifiably favors the interests of one group above another. And so if we didn't count at all the suffering of non-human animals, that would be speciesist. But those who do it are not usually denying that they suffer completely. So they, in that sense, they would not be, in my view, neo-Cartesian. They would just be speciesist.
My guest is Joseph Lynch. He's a philosopher at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. This issue of animal suffering is not just a philosophical one, but it's a religious one too. And you're not a theologian. Nevertheless, it does seem to me that some religious groups and religious people have struggled over this issue. On the one hand, they might look at animals as being part of God's creation. Mm. On the other hand, some religious people seem to be rather unwilling to grant the animals the status of having a soul. And that seems to relate to this whole issue, does it not?
Yeah, I think so. And it's true. I don't do work in theology. There's a friend of mine at Oxford, Andrew Lindsay, who has written extensively on theology and animal ethics. And in fact, it was a work of his that kind of motivated my interest in sort of the problem of God and animal suffering, because what a lot of people don't realize is that the immense amount of animal suffering is one of the things that caused Charles Darwin to sort of eventually give up his faith in God. It was, you know, if you want to say, well, human beings have an obligation to minimize animal suffering in some way, and if God is the author of creation, it doesn't seem like God has worked real hard to minimize animal suffering. So it is a tough problem for the theistic view. And in fact, partly what I want to argue in that paper, there seems to be a kind of incompatibility with a moral deep concern with animals and at least some versions of theism.
Joseph Lynch, professor of philosophy at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. He's in Sacramento today to give a talk about animal suffering and human attitudes towards animal suffering. His talk is titled God and Animal Zombies. It starts at 1:30 this afternoon at the Sacramento State University Union. That's a public event. He has got other events on campus too. Joseph Lynch, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how did a 1,400-year-old metal buckle from Asia end up in a remote part of Alaska? You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Here's your weather. In the valley today, it'll be sunny with a high in Sacramento of 60. And in Sacramento, there are just a few days left to see an unusual art show called Small. None of the artworks are more than 12 inches large, and some are smaller than an inch. It's at the Tangent Gallery in Franklin Boulevard. The show runs through Saturday. Otherwise, in weather, 59 today in Roseville, 61 in Modesto, 50 in Grass Valley, 46 in Reno, and 41 degrees in South Lake Tahoe. Mostly sunny tomorrow by the afternoon. How did a 1,400-year-old metal buckle from Asia end up in a remote part of Alaska? That's the question scientists are asking. Just a few months ago, some archaeologists were working in the Seward Peninsula in northwest Alaska. One of the people working there was Jeremy Foyne, a doctoral student from UC Davis, and he's the one who actually laid hands on this buckle, and he joins us. Jeremy Foyne, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me on the program, Jeffrey.
When you saw this buckle, what did you think it was?
Well, I could tell right away that it was something that that didn't fit in with what we're used to looking at in these sites. The particular culture we're looking at here is their tool technologies mainly based on bone, antler, ivory, that sort of thing. So this thing was found in the sifting screen that I was using, and it was pretty clear. I saw it on the screen. It had a very unusual shape, but there was some soil clinging to it. I pulled the soil off and saw that it was some sort of cast metal object. And at first I wasn't sure what I was looking at, and followed pretty quickly by disbelief. And then after that, the realization that it was probably something pretty significant.
At first, did you wonder if it had maybe just fallen from an airplane or that some other person passing through in the not-too-distant past had maybe dropped it there, or was it obviously something that had been there for a long, long time?
It was quite obvious it had been in the ground for a long time. The context it was found in was very secure. It was found about a meter underground in what looked to be a passageway in the house we were digging in. It's unclear whether it was several houses or one large house. But it was in a passageway, which is a very secure context, a very well stratified soil, no evidence of any rodent activity or anything like that. It was clearly undisturbed. The only possibility, perhaps, is that it might be older than the house. What you frequently see in these houses when they're constructed, because they're semi-subterranean, they're dug into the ground, often in the course of building the house, older artifacts get turned up and end up higher. Because they're removed and then turned to the side.
So it wasn't actually something that the people in the house were using, perhaps. It was just happened to be unearthed by them.
It's really difficult to say. That's a possibility. We've done a radiocarbon date on the artifact. It had a small piece of leather attached to it, and that returned a date of 600 AD. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's when it was deposited in the house. That's one of the things with archaeology. It's not always clear how things got there. But it's not plausible that it's younger. It was buried too deeply.
Could you describe the buckle for us? What does it look like? How big is it?
It's about 2 centimeters long by maybe 1 to 1.5 centimeters wide.
And so that's just about an inch, not even an inch across.
Yeah, it's quite small. One end is a bar that the leather is attached to. It's a piece of stitched leather, and that is connected to what looks to be a ring, which has been broken in half.
And what would that buckle have been used for?
We're not really sure at this point. Everybody on the project basically works with hunter-gatherers on the Alaska side of the Bering Strait, so none of us are very familiar with Asian artifacts in the historic period. So what we're doing now is trying to find people who can tell us what it was possibly used for. The early indications look like perhaps it was a horse ornament or something like that, but it's a little difficult to say.
My guest is Jeremy Foyne. He's a doctoral student in the UC Davis Department of Anthropology. A few months ago, while working in the Seward Peninsula of Alaska with other archaeologists, he found a brass buckle that was much older than the old houses that he was working on and did not otherwise seem to belong, quote unquote, to the area. Tell us about these houses that you're working on. How old were they?
The particular house where this buckle came from is uncertain because we have not got radiocarbon dates back on things recovered from within the house yet. It looks to be pretty early, maybe 900 to 1,000 years old. The other features we were working on this site is composed of beach ridges, which form over time. So the ridges furthest from the ocean can be assumed to be the oldest since they form in a sequence. We excavated two houses on the ridge, one ridge up closer to the beach, and those are look to be in the range of 1200 to 1400 AD.
So it does seem that the buckle is at least a couple of hundred years older than the houses.
Yes.
How do you know, or why do you think, that the buckle is from Asia and not from Alaska?
As far as we know, there's no evidence of metallurgy, especially casting in Alaska. That type of activity, smelting and casting metal, leaves a very obvious archaeological signature. And there's no evidence of that in Alaska.
Well, the obvious question here is then, how could this brass buckle, at least a couple of hundred years old at that time, have made its way to the Seward Peninsula?
This is not totally unexpected. There's a long history of exchange across the Bering Strait, even back in cultures preceding well before this buckle. And even if you want to go all the way back to the peopling of the New World, I'm sure many people have heard the Bering Land Bridge. Alaska was the eastern end of that. So it's seen many movements of people back and forth. These later cultures that we're looking at were highly maritime adapted, so they had watercraft. There's clear evidence of cultural exchange across the Bering Strait going both ways. So it's not that surprising that we found it. It was unexpected, of course.
Where about in Asia do we know would this buckle have been made?
Well, it's not clear right now. The speculation now is perhaps Korea, the steppe region of Mongolia, or perhaps China.
Well, that's quite a broad area.
It is, yes. The thing about historic archaeology, that is archaeology that involves artifacts with written history, is it's easier to figure out where they came from. So we should be able to compare this buckle against collections in other parts of Asia and to try and identify it.
If it came from as far south as Korea, then that means it traveled a long way, however it did so, to end up in Seward.
That's correct. I think at this point it's looking more like China or Mongolia is the more likely region, simply because of proximity. Things do move. They're traded between people, and they can slowly move as they're exchanged. But given the radiocarbon date on the buckle, which I should repeat is not necessarily the age of the buckle, the radiocarbon date was performed on the leather, and it's within the realm of possibility that the native folks who found this buckle or had this buckle put a new piece of leather on it. They're very adept at working skin.
The people who became the native people of the American continent, as I understand, came, or at least most of them did, originally from Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that perhaps the ancestors of the people who lived in this house that you're excavating, that they in turn came from Asia and perhaps brought the buckle with them?
It seems pretty likely. There's been multiple migrations across the Bering Strait over time. There's a clear Asian influence in the pottery you see and also decoration styles in earlier cultures. Once the connections were established, it seems less likely that there were later migrations of new people. What you get past a certain point is in situ or in-place cultural development. The Bering Strait's a very rich area in terms of its biological productivity. So there's a lot of culture, I guess you could say, sort of boiling in that area in that point in time.
But if people came to Seward ultimately from Asia and brought products of technology from Asia, do we know why they didn't also bring the technology with them?
You mean metal casting?
Yes.
The technique for metal casting? Well, it's an intensive process. Metal is valuable to hunter-gatherer groups simply because its durability. It's a superior material for cutting tools as opposed to stone or some sort of chipstone or groundstone, excuse me. The process of casting metal, it requires several technological systems that are not necessarily easy to acquire. Also, the raw material sources don't tend to co-occur. Copper and tin are usually found separately, with the exception of two areas in Thailand and Iran. So it's always involved trade, bringing the raw materials together. And then you have to have the smelting technology and the casting technology. It's just unlikely that hunter-gatherer groups at this time would be using a technology like that.
And we literally have just a few seconds left, but Jeremy Foyne, when you and your colleagues were working in the Seward Peninsula, you also got local high school students involved?
That's right. UC Davis has a long tradition, like many other institutions, of running archaeological field schools. It's the best way to train the next generation of archaeologists. And as a person who's attended field school myself, it's a good way to figure out if you want to do that. But
can't be too many high schools in the Seward Peninsula.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, there's not that many. So this was sort of a field school within a field school. We took undergrads from UC Davis and a few other schools, trained them in archaeological field methods for the first 4 weeks, and then a group of high school students were brought in from the local communities. It's part of a National Park Service mentorship program, and the UC Davis Field School has then trained them in archaeological techniques. And it's a good way to build relationships with the community, which is an important thing.
I can imagine. Jeremy Foyne, doctoral student in the UC Davis Department of Anthropology. We've been talking about this buckle that he found on an archaeological dig in the Seward Peninsula, a remote part of Alaska. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer, Lynn Weaver. She also engineered today. The assistant producer, James Morrison. The technical director of Insight is Mark Jones. And the senior producer, Jan Picard. We'll be back tomorrow. At Insight, we have one goal.
Wanting to get more insight.
To get the answers you want to hear.
That's a very good question.
Good to be here in the culture bunker.
It's interesting that you asked.
I'm glad you asked.
From interesting people of every stripe.
You really have delved into my deepest, darkest secrets.
What do you got to bring that up for?
Kind of give you more of a deep, more serious insight.
Well, this could work.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.